you will talk about capturing variation in the language documentation corpus. And I suppose we are following up on your paper here. Okay.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, I'm thinking of this talk as a nice continuation of the first talk we have heard in this panel. I just come from a slightly different perspective, I guess. So, is this working? This is not moving. How can I switch on to the next one? I just want to switch to the next slide, which is not happening. Should be working in progress, right?
Okay.
Thank you.
Fun. Let me take a look. Would it be okay? Maybe should we try fixing it?
Sure. Can you do that? I will just keep talking for the moment. So. Yeah, it's that one. So, of course, in language documentation, we are dealing with natural text, and so we naturally encounter a lot of variation if you're interested in variation or not. And I think traditionally we have left variation mostly to the realm of social linguistics, and obviously there are also social linguistic studies of languages that are lesser studied, and undescribed, endangered, and I'm referencing mostly work that has been done in Africa, which is my geographical specialty. So particularly in Africa, people have been looking at multilingualism, for instance, or urban youth languages. But there still seems to be this quite this disconnect to social linguistic approaches. Okay, thank you. In the worst case scenario, I can also use my computer. This is weird. It opened, but then I cannot switch to the next slide.
But now does it open?
Now it won't open again. Oh,
let's do this.
Oh, maybe then if we can do, and then maybe if you can scroll down instead of,
thanks so much. Yes. Okay, that works. Okay, so going back to this slide. So of course, there are social linguistic studies in underdocumented languages. But there still seems to be this disconnect to social linguistic perspectives, which often target individual variables rather than the whole language, and also it requires often a good deal of knowledge of data on the language under study. And only recently has it been the case that scholars try to combine language documentation and social linguistics approaches. So why is it the case that in language documentation we seem to often actively or less actively try to overlook variation? So from the perspective of somebody who is writing a grammar from scratch at the same time, of course you grapple with so many other issues to find the underlying system in the first place that you would maybe like to abstract away from the variation that you find. And also, as we have heard before, there are often purist views on language, also referred to as the ancestral code, trying to find the idealized version of a language as it has been spoken before shift and endangerment maybe set in. And obviously, a language documentation project is a vast undertaking, and you may just have other project and research priorities. The community may have other priorities. So trying to do everything at once is, of course, difficult. However, I would like to make the point that we should care about variation if we take the goals of language documentation seriously. And going back to Himmelmann 1998, we tried to document the linguistic practices and traditions of a speech community. So variation as is, of course, part of language as a social practice. And as variation turns up in the natural use of language, we should definitely cover that and try to cover all kinds of registers and varieties, social or local, as much as possible. And I think especially in endangered language situations, this is particularly relevant because we may actually see interesting types of shift and may be able to compare this to better studied languages that are not under shift. And so I go with what Ameka calls for, to strive for documenting diversity in communities of practice, and as well strive to use methods that do not eliminate and kill diversity, but which reflect diversity at all levels. All right, And a second point why we should care about variation pertaining to the goals of language documentation is that we are trying to create a multi-purpose record of a language, and that might be useful to others. So we have in mind that we are trying to create a record for people who may ask questions about the language that we're not even thinking about right now. And from my perspective, I think it also helps the person who is doing the description and documentation of a language, because it helps you to keep track of the types of variation or variants that you find. It may help you to make sense out of the variants that you find. All right, so recently there has been an upcoming interest in combining sociolinguistic approaches, both from the language documentation side, so Childs et al. Are more on the descriptive and documentary side, and they call for sociolinguistic documentation, and with that they mean that we should document sociolinguistic contexts in which lexicogrammatical codes are used. They have a particular emphasis on multilingual linguistic settings, and they give a bunch of recommendations pertaining to methodology, for instance, how you can enrich your corpus through a wide range of contexts that reflect important social features of a community, in addition to what we try to do already anyway in terms of having a diversity of speakers and different genres and different topics that we might want to cover in documentation. And they also suggest different or extended sociolinguistic metadata that will help to trace sociolinguistic or that will help to add sociolinguistic information. However, from a sociolinguistic perspective, it is not quite clear how this connects with common sociolinguistic practices, and I'm particularly thinking about that sociolinguistic practices are often driven by hypotheses on the social correlates rather than starting from the linguistic variants that we find. So it seems that the views on variation are pretty different in language documentation and description on the one hand and sociolinguistics on the other hand. So for once, the goals are very different in documentation and description. We want to describe the language or create a lasting multi-purpose record of language use, while in sociolinguistics, we try to map linguistic variables onto social correlates, maybe trace social and linguistic change. In documentation, we have description, we restrict our linguistic restricted to linguistic constraints. So you should see this showing up in grammars that people, of course, talk about allophony, but very often the social linguistic factors are not very much discussed, while in social linguistics, of course, there is a focus on social linguistic variation. In documentation, we are focused on endangered languages and understudied languages. Social linguistics has more well-studied languages. We have a difference between small and possibly large corpus size. And as you have mentioned before, in documentation, we try to study language at large, while in social linguistics, we focus more on individual variables and have potentially more experiments, while what we see in documentation and description, social variables are mostly impressionistic. So people may say, oh, this construction seems to be rather used by younger speakers, which may be true or not. So it seems that there are quite different views on this topic. So where do we even start then to combine that? And what I suggest is that we start with the data. And so today I'm mostly talking about how to present variation in a corpus as the major outcome of a language documentation project. And I'm not so much talking about how we should describe that in a grammar or in a lexicon, for instance. So I will be talking about different types of variation that I have encountered in our language documentation project, and then have a brief overview of how I came up with a working solution in Elan that works for me. And I would like to use that as a discussion point of how other people potentially code variation. So in terms of types of variation, there are, of course, different social factors that influence linguistic variation. And it has been well noted in the social linguistic literature that this is mostly correlating with gender, age, dialects on geographic location, socioeconomic categorization and register. But discovering these variables requires a lot of data. Often that is way more than we produce in a limited language documentation project. And it also requires a lot of knowledge about the social stratification of the language under study and the practices and the social practices of the speech community. So the approach in language documentation is rather different since we start bottom up, so we discover linguistic variants first, and then we hopefully later try to find the social correlates or factors. I also should, of course, mention that not all linguistic variants are the same, so they are those that are constrained by the language rules, like allophony, and I'm less interested in those in this talk. What I'm interested in here is those factors that are socially conditioned or that are unclear, and those often end up in descriptions as free variation, and social linguists are very wary of free variation. There's probably more to it. It just means that we haven't understood what's really going on. So let me show you some examples from the work that I have been doing on Geli, a Bantu language spoken in southern Cameroon. And for those of you who are not familiar with Bantu languages, there are quite a few. There are about 500 in southern Africa, and Bantuists classify them into groups that are marked with letters. So Geli is a Bantu A80 language spoken by so-called pygmy hunter-gatherers. It's an endangered language. There are about 4,000 to 5,000 speakers dispersed over a very large area. And speakers are currently changing their traditional way of life. Just a few years ago, the biggest port for Central Africa has been inaugurated just off the shore where they live, and that comes with more infrastructure, so they are forced to become more sedentary, do more farming, less hunting because the animals are gone, and in this whole subsistence shift, people are also shifting to the languages of neighboring Bantu farmers. And depending on which language they're mostly in contact with, different dialects are evolving. And in general, this is a very typical African setting where you have multilingualism on all levels and everybody easily speaks five languages. So the data comes out of a DOBUS project on Bakola, also called Bageli. So I was talking a little bit about the multilingualism, and you see this area here. So the purple area is Geli. And we collected in a collaborative effort with other linguists data from, well, two dialects, Nguma and Mabi. I was mainly working in the Bulu area, and we also had a colleague working in the Basa area. We have quite a bit of data, but the core natural text data that I focus on is about 540 intonation phrases, which took a long time because the tonal system is very complex. And I also should say that I didn't set out in this project to really document variation, and I wish that I had thought about doing this earlier and tracing variation in my corpus. That would actually have helped me quite a lot in my descriptive effort to write the grammar of Geli to understand the variation better. So, of course, there is a range of variation that I find in my data, and I cannot go through each of them in detail because I think each of them would require a talk on its own. But for instance, I see variants between sir and sure, and a voice plosive bur and implosive. There are grammatical morphemes that can be omitted or that show up. There is a variant between the completive marker between mo and ma. There are different lexical choices within the language. So for instance, there are two words for lion. I will show you in a second that there are different ways to signaling agreement. And of course, you find tons of borrowings and code switching. And I will just go into three examples in more detail. So about the phonetic variation between bur and bur. The question is, are we talking about plosives here? Are these implosives? Is there free variation, which is actually something that has been postulated for many surrounding languages in the area, in the literature. So the variation that we see is actually the voicing amplitude before the release, so we can get it either very flat. We also get the more implosive, typical looking like cone shape increase in amplitude. We also get sometimes something in between, which is very irregular. And this type of variation does not seem to be restricted to any phonetic or phonological environment, and it's found within the same speaker and across different speakers. And at this point, it's really not clear if this is a social or linguistic constraint, but this is variation that I see in my corpus. Then what I see in my corpus is that there is tons of ways you can agree with people. So you can say So I don't know how which would be, like, people would tell you, yeah, they are all fine and they all mean yes, and they all show up in the corpus. And then of course we also have code switching. Code switching is mostly between Kwasio, Bulu, and French, and I'm giving you examples of each of these different languages. As a practical thing in my annotations, I just mark it in the gloss line if something is not Yeli. And there are different targets, so either lexical words can be targeted, discourse particles, grammatical morphemes, and conjunctions, and it's pretty pervasive in the corpus. So what are things, so why should we care about this, and what are the things that these types of variation may tell us? So for some, I know a little bit better between the S and the Sh. It's dialectal variation. With the plosive, implosive, I'm not sure what it is. The lexical choices can give us some clues about lexical semantics, for instance, as we often just rely on translations. We all know that sometimes translations are just not good enough, and if you see that you have two different words that do different things, you get a better idea of what these lexemes actually mean. Borrowings can tell you about cultural influences and contact phenomena. I'm always blown away when I see English loan words or German loan words, which are expected in that area probably even after a long time, but where the English comes from, since the speakers have no contact with English, is really interesting. And then code switching also may tell you things about language prestige and language attitude. And generally, I think all of these different levels can help us to detect patterns of language shift. So for social linguistics, this should be actually pretty interesting. So methodologically, what do you do about these different types of variation? And I should say this was a non-exhaustive list. I'm sure there are more. And as I said also, I didn't set out in this project to trace variation, but this is the most obvious things that I came across. So we deal with so many things in language documentation and working with the community and our own research, and I often get reactions from other disciplines telling me, well, you should definitely do this in your project because this is really interesting, and of course I can't do everything, so why would I go through the trouble of marking variation? So I think, for one thing, going back to the multi-purpose record issue, if you want to let other people know that there is variation, there is no way they can get this from your transcription. It's really impossible to get that from your transcription alone. And even if you have a meticulous phonetic transcription that does not easily indicate variation phenomena to the user. So how would they know that I was not just being inconsistent about transcribing syllables? Sure. And there is no way that I can expect anyone to tell apart if people are using Yeli or Bulu or Kwasio, so I have to let people know what is going on. And at the same time, I also think it's very important for the researcher themselves to understand variation if they at the same time try to describe the language. So the practical solution that I came up with was just using Elan, and I think that most people are familiar with Elan. So it's a tool for time-aligned annotation that allows you to link audio and video files and have different tier levels where you do the annotation. So you could just have a variation tier, and then you can insert at least notes as you go and just mark something. And that is at least more information than saying nothing. If you want to be a little bit more systematic, you could use a controlled vocabulary, and that's what I ended up with. And the nice thing about that is that it speeds up your annotation if you have a limited number of variants. It helps you to be consistent, and that, of course, facilitates your searches later on. So it's very straightforward. You go to edit and then edit controlled vocabularies. A window will pop up where you have to name your controlled vocabulary. So you give it a name, you give it a description, and then in the bottom part you add the variables. So I add all my variables there, And I'm happy to discuss if this is a good way or there should be a better way of how you mark them, because what I basically distinguish is that I have a sir sh variation here, but from that you still don't know if in this particular context it is sir or sh, so you would have to go back and check for that. But this is a preliminary way of indicating watch out, here is some variation. So, and then there's a third step you have to do. You have to link your controlled vocabulary to the variation tier. You do that by adding a new tier type. And there you just basically have to give it a name and tell it to look up the controlled vocabulary that you have set up. And then when you do your annotation, you will get this drop-down menu and you can choose from that. Makes everything very consistent, and it's also nice because up here you can trace all your annotation, different types of variation annotation. So to conclude, I hope that I made clear that it might be very useful to code variation in your corpus, both for the multipurpose record of your corpus to other people, as well as a method for understanding variation and describing it. And I also think this is even a more low-level solution than what you have suggested. It may be less scary, not using R here, but just something that you can integrate into an already existing workflow. I also think that it adds a dimension on language use and situation that you otherwise wouldn't get from your corpus. And I think it could be a good starting point for a broader discussion on how to represent variation in a corpus. And of course, the challenge is that you have language-specific variation. And at the same time, we may want to think about ways how we can make variation tiers cross-linguistically comparable. And hopefully that would be a methodological step towards combining social linguistics and language documentation practices through creating resources also particularly for social linguistic researchers who may then be less confused about how to integrate underrepresented and endangered languages in their studies. So thanks very much.
I had a question. So you have a lot of types of variations, for example, about the phonological variations between S and SH, just one example. Why would not just the gloss, because you're making a gloss, right, also in your transcription.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the free
yes.
morphemes.
Yes, yes, yes.
So if you have the gloss and the link between gloss and transcription, why would that not be sufficient for tracking, for example, phonological variations? What would be the benefits of adding this variation tier for this specific type of variation, right, and S and SH categories? Because if you have the gloss in the phonological transcription, wouldn't that be sufficient?
So, hold on.
It's just your question.
Yes. So you mean the gloss type, like on the so in the gloss type, I gloss grammatical morphemes and lexical items so that there is variation. You don't see that in the gloss. You may see that sometimes you get it in the transcription line, that you get sometimes sir and sometimes sure. But if I'm looking at even at my own data, let alone other people who don't know about the data, how would they know that this is an instance of variation? Does that make sense?
But if you take the phonological forms that is corresponding to this particular gloss, then you would see a lot of variations.
You search for it.
Yes. So, but you still have to indicate to people that there are certain things that you need to search for variation, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a way to boost research search of variation. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank
yes.
So I can't see very well.
Oh.
So on your variation tier. Is that tier a dependent tier of one of your others, and what level are you connecting it to? Is
okay.
It your word level, or how do you have that tied up? It's a little hard to tell.
So I would have wanted to make it a dependent tier. I have had problems with Elan in the last 2 years making dependent tiers, so I would probably have made it a dependent tier either on the on the intonation phrase level or on to the morpheme break level, and that probably. Yeah, so that's a good question because, I mean, some variation is on the phoneme level and other is on the lexical level. So as a compromise, I would make it dependent on the morpheme break, but at the moment I cannot have dependent
so
tiers.
So it's just independent right now. So were you, I mean, your boundaries are lining up with something.
Yes.
So were you just copying the annotation from one of the tiers, whichever one
yes,
sort of corresponded?
Yes, I align it with a morpheme break.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Which, again, is depending on the language, if
yeah,
that makes sense or not.
Somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. This is really interesting. And yeah, I have a similar question about the coding of variation. And I think that having a close vocabulary definitely speeds things up. And I'm curious if there's any way to automate it. So I think one thing that he was referring to is if you have all the information there, you could potentially say, like, do a search and replace with a copy of the tier or something like that, or run a script or something to automatically detect all those situations where all the information lines up,
mm-hmm.
and then code it directly in the tier. So is that another way that you
think? I think that would be very useful, especially for larger corpora. If you have so many thousands of, ten thousands of words, I think that would be the next level to automate this. My corpus is small enough that I can go through it, but yeah, the larger ones, that would be definitely a way to go.
Have another question about the loan words,
mm-hmm.
the borrowings when you're code switching. I think this is a very tricky question, right?
Super tricky.
Because so multilingual setting, and for example, if you have a borrowing that is here for several generations, been here for several generations, the only way to say that
yes.
is to use the borrowing. It's not
mm-hmm.
code switching because
mm-hmm.
it's integrated into language. How do you make these decisions about borrowings?
So I think I cannot. Okay, so some things are more obvious than others,
yes.
obviously. So with where I can clearly say it's a borrowing and it's part of the language is when it gets phonologically integrated, and I would see this in a Bantu language through, for instance, noun class prefixes and,
okay,
and
yeah.
that stuff. So in Geli it is pretty obvious, and at the same time you still see that that word comes from English or French. It has a particular, it still looks different tonally and in terms of its phonological structure. You see it clearly that it comes from English or from French. So those are the easy cases. With the code switching, I mark this as code switching at the moment, and those are discourse particles that come from French. So the Bageli usually don't speak French, and if they get any French influence, it's through the other neighboring Bantu languages, because everybody there speaks French. So they would say something like donc, alors, and stuff like that. That has not been phonologically adjusted to the language. So I, at the moment I say it's code switching, but I agree that making the decision is sometimes really hard. And so I generally, sometimes I also just refrain from saying this is a loan word or borrowing. I just say the source is Budu or Kwasio.
Okay,
and I'm not making any theoretical assumptions yet about whether this is borrowing. And
because
yeah.
if you had a methodology about borrowings, that would be very interesting.
Yes, yes.
You want to help other people too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, yes. One more question.
Can I make just a quick comment, if I may? I thought this was great. About I can see personally a utility of this variation tier in a project that I'm working on. The principal investigator has only had time since she recently put together this corpus from 2015 to 2018. To have a transcription tier. And she has not gone through and been able to do this morpheme by morpheme gloss or been able to do a more detailed phonetic tier, but I am currently going through and doing binary coding of the variable. And so in our case, just searching, there wouldn't be the information that this kind of tier would provide, especially as someone who's jumping on the project without the same kind of expertise that my collaborator has. And so I could see being able to use this today if I wanted to jump in and create that tier and add that coding instead of just in my spreadsheet, actually into the Elan files, which could later, once they're more, have the other information my collaborator would like for them to have, be deposited into the archive. And so I just wanted to thank you and say that.
Thank you.
See the utility of this right away.
Thank you.
Yeah.